It is the podcast for a Tuesday. Bob McCone and John Shannon with you, as per usual. You okay, Shannon?
Well, I have to do a mea culpa first of all. Oh. Apparently I gave the Canadians one too many medals.
One too many?
Yeah, yeah. There aren't that many, so it's easy to count. Apparently I gave them an archery medal. No, not apparently. I did give them an archery medal. I must have been hallucinating. So a couple of guys on Twitter, at William Tell and at Robin Hood, really got after me. So
William Tell and Robin Hood.
Yeah. No, anyway, so we did not win. We did not win a medal in archery. So at this point, as we record, Andre DeGrasse is in fact the only male to have won a medal at the Tokyo Olympics for Canada.
Well, I think I alluded to that.
Yeah, for some reason, whether it was I'm trying to do the 13-hour time change every time to try to watch things live all the time, and the CBC app is so good, it's so much fun to bounce through all the different venues. I had them winning a medal where they didn't. So,
well, shame on you.
I know, it's first time I've made a mistake today. And it won't be the last.
Well, actually, the mistake was made yesterday, or the day before, or one Friday.
How do you know? With the podcast, you never know. Guy could have listened to two in a row.
Upcoming, as we record this, both Andre DeGrasse and Aaron Brown have chances for medals. And quite possibly even gold. Aaron Brown beat the favorite in his heat, which doesn't necessarily mean anything because guys slow up. And Andre DeGrasse set a Canadian record at 19.73 seconds. And this is actually an event he's better at than the 100.
That's what they say.
Well, because he doesn't have the greatest start, but he has an excellent late kick, which he showed in the 100 meters. He was dead last for the first 25 meters of that race. And then poured it on and got the bronze medal. So we shall see how that unfolds. I think that happens Wednesday morning early.
Over the next 24 hours.
All things in the morning early. That's redundant.
That's part of our problem right now, trying to do. I'm so silly trying to do the time change conversion. I don't know why.
Why bother?
I don't know. That's the old TV guy in me trying to. So what time is that? And what do we put on the score, the board that says what time it is in Canada? But it's 13 hours difference from the Eastern time zone.
What if you watch the Olympics, what's your primary channel or do you bounce?
Oh, I have fallen in love with the app. The CBC app, which is on CBC Gem, is fantastic. You can watch replays. You basically become your own programmer. So you can watch the live show that's on the air on the network, or you can go to each individual venue and watch the proceedings of the venue raw. The technology is spectacular. Very good.
Well,
So I'm an Apple TV guy, or anybody has a smart TV can download CBC Gem. It's free. I mean, well, it's not free. You and I pay for it in our taxes every week. And then within the CBC Gem app, there is a CBC Olympics app that is just, it's phenomenal. The pictures are beautiful. The commentary is simple. If there is any commentary at all, that's the way I watch most of the golf. I could tune in and tune out and watch the golf anytime I wanted.
I have absolutely no idea what you're referring to, but it sounds intriguing.
Bob, come on.
No, technology.
It's 2021. I'll come over and try to set it up on your TV.
Sure, just like you came over to pick up your dog food.
I got my my dog food.
Yeah, you got your dog food because I basically delivered it to your neighborhood.
Yes, you did, yeah. It was very kind of you.
Yeah, it was very kind.
You're just trying. There was no kindness at all. You were just trying to get rid of it as you prepare for your move.
Well, it sat inside my door. Those three big bags sat inside my front door for like a month.
You must have a small dog. Those are well-sized bags. They are not big bags.
Well, they're pretty
big bags. When you have big dogs, you have big bags.
Well, they're pretty big bags. Now, are your dogs
loving every moment?
Are they?
Yeah. Lucy's right here. She's going to tell you any second.
So. Well,
Kevin's still asleep, so
we can hold off on that. Blue Jays got a new pitcher, and he was extraordinary in his first start. Had a couple of innings where he got in a bit of trouble, but wiggled his way out of that.
Yep.
And the Toronto Raptors see the departure of Kyle Lowry, which is not shocking, not unexpected in any way, shape, or form. But nonetheless, the reality has hit, and we'll discuss those things. Steve Simmons will join us along with Rob Longley, and we'll get to that after these messages. McCown and Shannon with you again, and we are joined by Steve Simmons, Rob Longley, both with us. A couple of guys who have spent a few years in this racket.
They're kind of like they're the DeGrasse and Brown of post media. You know, they're good. At really good partnership.
Well, I got thank goodness it's not a relay. Well, let's talk about, we were going to talk about baseball. We'll get to that. The departure of Kyle Lowry has created quite a Twitter in the marketplace, and I guess justifiably so. What bothers me a little bit is this notion that it is unquestioned that Kyle Lowry is the greatest player to ever play for the Toronto Raptors. And we started seeing, or I started seeing, postings of proposed bronze statues outside of the dome.
Including your buddy, the mayor.
Or the arena, I suppose, more accurately. What did the mayor?
Oh, he piped in, suggesting there might be a statue.
Well, and no disrespect intended, but is this a little overkill, Simmons, to you?
It's a touch of overkill, but it's not Toronto or Canada overkill, if you can understand the distinction I'm making. If we were in New York or Chicago or Los Angeles or Boston, and Kyle Lowry was moving on, it would be a headline and it would be a column, and there would be consternation of some kind, but there would be none of that greatest of all time and all the, what you're hearing in the past 24 hours and maybe hearing since the season ended. And I think Kyle Lowry was a very good player for a Toronto Raptors team that went from being embarrassingly bad to winning a championship. And he was central to all of that, although not central completely to them winning a championship. They obviously had to bring Kawhi Leonard in to do that. But he was the constant from the beginning to the title being won, to what came afterwards. And he was sort of the one guy you could look to he's the greatest in the history of the franchise. It's a horrible franchise historically. I mean, if you look at the entire history, and they haven't had very many great players, and they haven't had, you know, Chris Bosh is going to the Hall of Fame, although I'm not quite sure why. So Kyle Lowry had a great run, and it was great to watch him grow up. And I don't mean grow up like he needed to grow up. I mean, just naturally. Mm-hmm. We all grow up between the ages of 26 and 35. We all change. And I think what we saw in Kyle Lowry was he went from being a guy that was really hard to like to a guy you couldn't stop loving.
No, I'll give you that.
I think that's what happened more than anything else here.
So he was here how long? Longly?
Nine years.
9 years. At what point was he the best player on the Toronto Raptors?
See, that's a good point. Now, admittedly, Bob, I haven't followed basketball as close as others in this market.
Sure.
I must admit that the love-in last night, I got off the golf course and turned on the radio, and the talk had already started about the greatest Raptor of all time. And I thought, my goodness, is this just recency bias, or have I missed something here over the last 9 years? I mean, obviously he was an outstanding player. Obviously he was a great player with the Raptors. And I think if you're going to enhance his legacy or describe his legacy, it is that he played here for 9 years, and that it is that he won a championship here. But Kyle Lowry isn't the main reason that the Raptors won a championship. He was a good franchise player for a long time and deserves some platitudes, but I'm not so sure that we have to put the statue up right now, unless you're going to put it beside Zach Hyman. Is that what we're going to do?
That may be a slightly unfair comparison, but I get it.
Here's the problem right now is that there's this giant piece of heart been taken out of the market in Zach Hyman, Kyle Lowry. And so Toronto loves Feist.
Yeah, character guys. Yeah.
They love that kind of player. And I think that's part of the narrative with Kyle Lowry is they love that kind of a player. Is he an all-time great NBA player? No. He's going to be in the Hall of Fame, I think, but everybody in the NBA gets in the Hall of Fame when you're any good. He'll get there one day. But think at what Rob's a good point. At what time was he 15th best player in the NBA? Was he ever that?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
What I want to know is if Kyle Lowry can get, $90 million for 3 years in Miami with Pat Riley. What does Pat Riley see in Lowry that this organization doesn't? Any thoughts, Steve?
I think what happened in the playoffs was illuminating to me. All these teams tried to pick up Lowry at the deadline. The Knicks tried. I think the Clippers tried. The Heat tried. The 76ers tried. And one by one, they all went down quite quickly in the playoffs or badly in the playoffs. And it was like, if we only had Kyle Lowry, how much would that have changed the Lakers? How much would that have changed the Heat? He's a perfect complement. He's not going to be, he doesn't have to be your best player. He's a perfect complimentary guy in the circumstance, mm-hmm. as he was to Kawhi Leonard in Toronto when he was the second best player on the Raptors. And I think these teams all look and say one additional piece to what we already have will put us in that championship, circumstance or in that championship debate of sorts. And $30 million is just the going rate, John, although it's awfully hard to think you're doing it to a guy 36 years old. But it's the going rate now in the NBA for a player of that caliber.
That's what Chris Paul got too. So.
Yeah, I mean, almost by definition, that's what you're paying for when you pay that kind of money is not a role player, but a good complement to the stars in the team. And if you look at, like Steve said, I mean, you get a character guy, a proven guy in the playoffs, and a guy that can help you win, can be a big part in taking you over the top. He's not going to be the main guy that gets you there, but he's going to be a very good complementary piece. 3 years, maybe you're paying a premium for the first 2 years because by the end of it, he'll be getting a little long in the tooth. But, I mean, you could see why a guy like Pat Riley would make a move like this.
I was in Rio for the Olympic gold medal game. The United States won, and Kyle was on the U.S. Olympic team. And just to give you a sense of sort of where he fit into American basketball, I think he was about the eighth player on the Olympic team. And he didn't play a whole lot of minutes, and he wasn't a game-changing guy at that level. And, and probably five or six players or seven players weren't there that could have been there. And so it sort of gives you a sense of where he fits into the league numbers wise. But, the dollars these days are the dollars. I mean, mm-hmm. I take the Lou Lamoriello approach to every contract now signed in free agency. It's too much money and it's too long.
Well, I think Miami's interest is a case of that happens consistently in sports, and that is the grass is always greener. The other guy's guy is more alluring than your own. And it raises the issue of the Raptors' decision to let him go, which essentially they did. And I think that tells you something, that nobody knows Kyle Lowry better than Masai Ujiri or the rest of the staff or Nick Nurse, the head coach. If they thought they were sure he had enough in the tank to be an impact player for the next year, 2 years, hopefully, three would be a stretch. Why wouldn't they pay him the $30 million? Which is essentially what they've been paying him the last how many years? Mm-hmm. A bunch.
Several. Yeah.
I guess it's its term that they didn't want to pay whatever term Lowry and his camp were demanding because of they've probably seen a little bit of decline in his game and certainly projected that to be more so 2 years down the road. So they didn't want to give him term would be my guess.
Well, there was also some health issues in the last year.
Sure.
He missed a lot of time in this shortened season. And here's the thing, Bob, what we don't know. We don't know where the Raptors are heading right now. Masai still is without a contract. They've made no real significant moves yet of any kind. We don't know who, if any free agents are coming in. We don't know what kind of, who comes in on the sign of trade. And more importantly, who stays.
Right.
Sign and trade. Like, which guys, do they take Goran Dragic and then send him somewhere else? You know, who do they keep? What is their team going to look like? Is Pascal Siakam on this team? You know, first and foremost, I want to see Masai's name on a contract and then see where the Raptors go from here. And knowing him as well as I do and as we do, he's going to find a way to win because that's the only thing he's interested in doing.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say that we all believe that Masai and Maple Leaf Sports Entertainment have some sort of framework of an agreement. Masai seems to be doing his job.
Bob, it's the first week in August. He better have something in the drawer. I mean, we're talking about 60 days to camp.
No, and that's my point, John, is I think the debate or the concern that Masai may be leaving should be put to rest pretty much. I think mm-hmm. we're at 99.9% that he's going to be around. And the truth of the matter is, if they never announce that he has a new contract, what do I care? He's going to get paid a lot of money for a president and deservedly so, I suppose. And the other thing I think is, as we take a look at, and Steve alluded to this and Rob too, as we look at the unfolding of this team, do we have confidence that Masai Ujiri can pull a rabbit out of his hat? Well, I think we have to because he's done it before. And we don't know what it's going to look like, but I assume it's not going to look exactly like what it looks like today. Mm. Well, let's put the Lowry thing to bed and focus a little bit on the Toronto Blue Jays. Is this a team that is, I was going to say good enough, but are there enough pieces here and enough, do we have enough confidence that this team can be in it in September? Longley, this is your wheelhouse.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how this unfolds. I mean, are they good enough? They're certainly improved post-trade deadline than pre-trade deadline. They certainly can score a lot of runs. I mean, their run differential is crazy. It's well over 100. And I think they're going to be better equipped to close out games. But if I'm a Blue Jays fan, my concern now is there too much left to do? They're a team that's really been 3 to 4 games above 500 for most of the season, and they're going to need to be almost 20 games above 500, but by the end of it. The Yankees are still ahead of them. The Red Sox are fading a little bit, but because Tampa's past them, but there's still a long way to go there. And even Seattle and Cleveland are slightly in the mix for this wild card race. So, my concern would be that there's too much to do. And they haven't really shown us a sustained run at any point in this season. We've seen the odd 3 or 4 game winning streak against sort of the dregs of the league. But when it comes to playing a team that's 500 or better in the mix of that schedule, they can't seem to extend a hot run. And to my projections, they're going to need to get to 92 wins probably. And to do that, they're going to have some serious win streaks along the way, much the way the 2015 team did. They're going to have to win 7 or 8 in a row, 9 of 10, 10 of 12. To get themselves in a position. Realistically, wild card is the best shot at this point. They're a much better team than they were, but I think they may have left themselves with a little bit too much to do.
Well, I don't really. I mean, I remember the 15 team, of course. We all do, but not to the degree that perhaps the analytics crowd does. But it seemed to me that team had a level of consistency and an ability to win close games. And if they had the lead going to the 8th or 9th inning, there was no concern. This team, for whatever reason, loses a lot more close games than they win. The fact that they've got their plus 100 runs tells you a lot, really, that when they're hot, they'll win by an enormous score. And when they lose games, generally, they don't get blown out. But they can't win the close one. And I really don't know what the psychology of that is. Simmons, do you have an opinion on that?
I love this roster.
I really, so do I.
I think this is the best Blue Jay. Throw the 2015 and 16 seasons out for a minute. This is, other than those two teams, this is the best Jays team we've seen in 25 years in terms of the talent level, in terms of the depth, in terms of...
Do you mean just offensively, those teams?
No. I mean, just put it, all the capabilities together, and yet they don't know, as Rob points out, they don't know how to win. And they have put themselves in a position now where they are so far behind in terms of how do you get to 90 wins that I don't think it's possible for them to get to 90 wins. Like, they're going to have to play like 770 baseball to do that. And I don't see that happening. There's only, what, 59 games left? You know, you're going to have to go on one heck of a streak. And, you know, they just seem to be able to run their way out of games, field their way out of games, pitch their way out of games, and not hit, with all their great hitting, not hit in the late innings.
Yeah.
Not hitting innings 7, 8, and 9. And so, yeah, that run differential number is astounding. And when you look around baseball, it's one of the best in baseball. But think of all of the games against all of the really bad teams in the American League that they've won 7 and 8 nothing. And so the run differential is a little bit misleading.
Oh, it's because, a lot misleading.
Because it's not, I'd love to see the run differential versus 500 teams versus the run differential versus non-500 teams.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's what I did the other day. I went and looked back at all their blowout wins. They've had 9 wins where they've won by 7 runs or more, and a few of those are 10 runs or more. So that gets your run differential up to 65 right there. I mean, obviously, anytime you have a positive run differential, you're going to have the odd blowout win. But 9 or 10 games winning by 7 or 8 runs, I think that kind of makes it a bit of a misleading statistic.
But Rob, isn't the one thing that's in the Blue Jays' favor is their schedule?
That's the other thing. Yeah. I mean, they did have a tough early schedule and they've got a lot of lightweights coming home. I mean, they're almost done with Boston, but a lot of lightweights where they're going to really have to beat up on and sort of get on that kind of run that I mentioned. And to me, I'm already looking at the last weekend of the season. The Yankees are in for 3 games and there's a really good chance that that's going to decide whether they're going to go to a wild card, but they're going to have to make sure they take care of business against the lesser teams of the American League along the way to even make that final series meaningful at all. But
see, I'd like to see the schedule actually different for them, because I'd like to see them having more games with Boston and more games with the Yankees and more games with Tampa, because then they got a chance to gain ground. When you're where they are, the fourth team in the American League East, I think they're fourth or fifth in the wild card race, then every time you win a game, one of those four teams is going to win. So you need, on the nights you win, you need 3 or 4 teams to lose to gain ground. Mm-hmm. And it's just so difficult to gain ground when you're not playing the teams that you got to catch.
Yeah, their 3-game winning streak over the weekend when they moved back to Toronto, they gained almost no ground because everybody else was winning. Steve makes a good point. And when you don't play them head-to-head, you just don't have that opportunity.
Let's take a quick break. We'll talk more about the Blue Jays and their fate this season when we come back after these messages. It's McCowan, it's Shannon, it's Simmons and Longley, as we are in the midst of conversation about the Toronto Blue Jays. The pitching staff, I mean, Steve said earlier, he loves this 25-man roster. I would say to you that there are still question marks and holes in this roster, but the starting pitching staff, after much chagrin in the early part of the year, if they remain healthy, might be as good as just about anybody's in baseball. Yes or no? Longley?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. I mean, the biggest issue that they've had pitching-wise, of course, has been the bullpen. And you know, you talk to anybody on the team off the record about that, and they'll willingly admit that. Now the bullpen has been bolstered a little bit, but it's really going to come down to starting pitching, because we've seen it, Bob. We've seen it all season that these guys are pitching deep into ball games, something we haven't seen for a couple of years around the Blue Jays. And when you acquire a guy like Berrios at the trade deadline, now all of a sudden you've got really, in theory, 3 horses at the top of the rotation. And then you can tweak the 4 and 5 spots as needed as you go along. But when you got Ryu and he's hitting his spots like he does when he's on his game, when you've got Robbie Ray having the kind of season that he has, and now you add Berrios, that's three horses there. And I think we're still going to see some really good pitching from Alek Manoah down the stretch. I mean, this guy's a really competitive dude, and he throws it hard, and he seems to be, he's never lacked confidence, but he seems to be really learning how to pitch at the major league level. And the fact that he was brought up so early is going to make him an important guy in September. So if you have four guys in a five-man rotation, you're pretty much as good as anybody in the American League, and certainly as good as anybody in the division.
Well, that's the frustration in all of this. The frustration in all of this is if they ever got to a playoff round, you know, you can set up your rotation anyway, but you got four guys that are all really good. And, you know, Ray has been one of the best starting pitchers in the American League this year. We know what Ryu is. You know, we know what Berrios is. And every time I watch Manoah, I'm more and more impressed. The problem, the frustration is that this team with this rotation at this time may not get there because it's just too hard and it's too far. And they've put themselves, and I don't even understand how, they've put themselves in position. Yeah, the bullpen has been bad, but everybody has. You look at the teams ahead of them. The Yankees have been lousy all year. How they're ahead of the Jays, I have no idea. The Boston Red Sox roster is unimpressive. They're what, eight games up? Mm-hmm. You know, how is this team with all this talent not better? How come it doesn't have more wins? How come, you know, I just don't understand how it is that this group has put themselves in a position to play 775 baseball to just make it to the wild card game.
A lousy bullpen, that's what does it, man. If you don't have a bullpen, you don't have anything. And you can see it, you know, you can see it in the frustration around the manager. You can see it in the frustration around the players. When you lose too many games like that with a bullpen coughing it up, it happened again on Sunday. It's tough. It's almost impossible to be a sustained success without that.
Well, even more so, given the nature of the way the game is played today and the use of starting pitchers, who you don't want anybody to throw more than 100 pitches most of the time, and you want to yank them after five innings or six innings or seven would be like absurd. And so now what happens is now you rely on your bullpen, and you don't just rely on one guy. And this is the other, if there's a piece of the puzzle that seems to be missing to me, and maybe it's missing in all of baseball, is the long reliever. The guy who can come in and give you two, three innings on some kind of regular basis. The guy who could bridge you from the sixth inning to the ninth inning in your closer. The Blue Jays will use two or three pitchers to get to the ninth inning. And when you do that, it seems to me that you're running the risk that at least one of them ain't going to have it that day. And, you know, the analytics tell you one thing, but your head and your eyes tell you something different. Or am I just an old coot, Simmons?
No, I agree with exactly what you're saying, and it drives me nuts. The 100 pitches drive me nuts. The can't go into the order three times drive me nuts. There's so many things that they're now doing. I mean, we saw it in the World Series, you know, in for the most extreme example you could come across.
And it failed, yeah.
Yeah, and it failed. You know, Bob, we've been around long enough to see when you have a guy who can be that middle guy, who can come in the third and pitch to the sixth, who can do that. I think it's an incredible value to have one of those rubber-armed kind of guys. Mm-hmm. Most championship teams historically have had them. And it seems now very few teams are using them because it's an inning or less per pitcher now. And you can't expose anything to anybody. And so, yeah, the numbers have changed everything, but I'm a great believer in finding roles for players. You know, you're my ninth inning guy. You're my eighth inning guy. You're going to pitch seventh. If the starter gets knocked out, you're in for the next three innings. I like having that on a ball team, and frankly, don't care what the numbers say about it in respect to that.
It's funny, about I would have told you 5 or 6 years ago, that's the way every Major League Baseball team was going. There was a time, you know, in the last decade where teams did have that three inning guy. And I want to, Rob, any idea what changed? I mean, why did it go away as quickly as it appeared?
Well, maybe there was an emphasis on developing closers and you know, really the guys that, with the high velocity, and that seems to be what so much of bullpen pitching is about these days, is velocity. But I mean, I actually think that the Jays may have a couple of answers for long guys coming from, and I think that they won't be shy to use it. And I talked to Charlie.
Well, Pearson would be one, wouldn't he?
Pearson would be one because it's almost certain that he's going to be back with the team, and it is certain that he won't be a starter. So he could be at least a 2 to 3 inning guy. And the other guy is Ross Stripling. I mean, I don't think that he's going to stay in the rotation. And I think he will be the odd man out, mainly because he's been a long guy before. That's what he did with the Dodgers. I mean, he threw some significant games for the Dodgers in the playoffs as a long guy. And he's a proven success at that role. And the Jays acknowledge that they need that. I mean, man, you're going to need some guys to get you from the 5th to the 7th or the 8th. And whoever emerges as what stands as a closer for the remainder of the season, they're going to need a guy to be literally the setup man that they haven't had. And I think both Pearson and Stripling are possibilities to fill that role.
When the Jays won World Series in 92 and 93, they had people like Jimmy Key,
Todd Stottlemyre.
Stottlemyre all in the bullpen when they needed them to be. Occasionally they would start a game, but when they needed them, they had them there. And if you go back to the Dodgers last year, the Dodgers had guys who weren't starting for them. They were starting pitchers who they went to, and they did real yeoman's work to get the Dodgers through to winning the World Series. And I think they sort of, you know, showed that you can still use that kind of pitcher when needed in the right circumstance.
Well, you, in fairness, you know, when you get to the World Series, you're going to have probably 3 starters, maybe 4,
right?
But probably only 3. So you got 2 other guys that can be inserted in that long relief kind of scenario or emergency long relief. More accurately, in 92, 93, what the Blue Jays did with guys like Stottlemyre, Key, Wells, a bunch of guys, they were young starting pitchers and they used them out of the bullpen to kind of get their careers started.
Mm-hmm.
And that philosophy has sort of disappeared from the game. And certainly in the Blue Jays scenario. Now, maybe Pearson will become that kind of guy, but that'll be more out of necessity, more because I don't think they trust him to be a starting pitcher. And they don't think he's good enough to be among their top 5, even 6. As long as everybody is healthy.
Yeah, and they can't build him up to be a starter yet either, because that's a whole
no.
thing well now too, right?
Didn't they kind of go through that with Aaron Sanchez though?
Sure, they did the same thing.
As yeah. a close, you know, was an 8th inning setup guy, and he was yep. terrific in 2015, I think, or whatever year it was.
Yep.
And then he became a starting pitcher where he led the American League in ERA before blisters and everything set him back.
Rob, any thought about Rogers Centre being a real advantage for this club now?
That'll be interesting to see. I mean, obviously they said all the right things when they came back on Friday about how it was nice to finally have a home. And, you know, I was talking to Montoyo about this on the field as well. And it's like literally they lived out of their suitcases for 2 years. So there's got to be at least some satisfaction to moving into a condo down in that part of the city for a couple of months where you can, you know, literally unpack and if you have family, you can bring them along. And I think the fans will be a bit of a factor. We saw, you know, decent crowds in the weekend, and I suspect that if things continue to trend in the right direction, maybe the capacity will double to closer to 30,000. But it's going to take some time getting used to the ballpark. I think we saw a few of the players maybe struggle a little bit with that on the weekend, but here's one thing. I think it's going to help their pitching, because balls aren't going to fly out of the Rogers Center the way they fell at a TD ballpark in Dunedin and in Buffalo, where some of those cheapo home runs helped the Jays run differential, but they also hurt them late in innings when the opposition took advantage of those situations as well. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a bit of a home field advantage. If you read Bo Bichette's comments, he wrote one of those Players Tribune things, and he was quite emotional about it. He thought, you know, it's like, We were tired of being on the road. We want to be home. Now, it's an easy thing to win over the fan base and say that kind of thing, but I think there'll be something at least a little bit tangible to being back at the Rogers Center.
Well,
one of the amazing things about this group is that so few of the guys have really played any meaningful baseball there. You know, when Guerrero was last here, he was a guy struggling to figure out where he is. And you look around, you know, Marcus Semien is new, and a lot of these guys are new, and Springer's new, and so they're just figuring out what it is. But as Rob points out, every player I spoke to on Friday seemed so happy to not be, and they kept using the same term, I'm not living out of a suitcase anymore. And, you know, we've all been on the road, and God, the road can become awfully tiresome when the trips are long, but when the trips are a couple of years in length, that's a lot longer.
Can't even imagine. I will say this much, as somebody who spent a lot of time in that facility watching baseball games, having 13,000, which is really what they have, 13 and change, because they're allowed 15 of everybody, and there's all kinds of staff that count in that number. So it's 13 and change. Having 13,000 in the ballpark as compared to 35,000 in the ballpark is a dramatically different scenario. And I don't think we have any reason to believe that we're going to get to 35,000 for the balance of this year. So whatever impact they get from the fans, and I never really understood that, is going to be mitigated by the fact that there's only 13,000 there. It's kind of like playing, it's kind of like the Oakland A's playing at home, you know?
Steve and I had this discussion the other night. People need 30,000 in that place for it to feel like a real, you know, home crowd.
Yeah, I think you need 30.
It sounded pretty good on Friday night, though. And that could have been because it was the first game.
Yeah, but, and they can crank up the audio, Simmons, you know.
But they had all the people together in they were, where's the social distance?
I was going to say, I'm not sure they're supposed to do that, are they?
Yeah. No, but they were all kind of together. And I thought, you know, Toronto crowds for every sport are kind of quiet. Like hockey crowds are quiet. Mm-hmm. Basketball crowds are, basketball is a little different, but the hockey crowd is quiet and the baseball crowd historically is quiet. That was a good, noisy Blue Jay crowd. Now, again, first game, first time for everybody being there. So I don't know if that's going to, the way it's going to go the rest of the season, but it there was atmosphere. There was a lot of atmosphere, I thought.
Well, if they can get to 30, then you'll see a lot more atmosphere.
Hey, Rob, I got to ask you, you were actually on the field talking to a player around the cage. I mean, what was that like?
That was like a weird, really weird thing. I mean, we're all zoomed out in this world now, and it was, you know, on the Blue Jay beat, and I'm sure it's the same with the other beats. Like there's, it's just, the players are tired of it. The media is tired of it. The manager's tired of it. And you can't talk about anything. Like you can't develop a relationship with somebody over Zoom. You've got to spend time in baseball, it's the best. You guys have all seen it. You can just spend time by the batting cage, just shooting the breeze with guys, go in the dugout, talk to a player, talk to a manager. And that's how you develop those relationships and trust, and eventually can do a better job at what you at covering the beat. But yes, like almost two full years of not being able to do that, it was kind of nice to be on the field and just catch up with guys for no other reason.
One conversation struck me in talking to Romano, who's from the Toronto area, relief pitcher with the Jays. And we started talking about how many tickets he had to buy for the game on Friday night. And his grandma, who we hadn't seen in 2 years, was going to be there. And his parents were going to be there. And his cousins and his uncles and this and that. And I'm thinking, there's not a chance on a Zoom call that we're getting into this kind of details.
And no, of course.
Kind of the richness of stories. And that's what I think has been missing from all of sports, is that we're all in these little boxes and we all get our one question and maybe a follow-up on a good day. And then it goes to the next guy who gets his question, which is completely unrelated to the question I just asked. And so it goes. And so there's no flow to any interview and there's no eye contact and there's no, as Rob points out, relationship made and or built. And that's, you know, we started the day talking about Kyle Lowry. One of the things I'm going to miss the most about Kyle Lowry is the 9 years I've spent, you know, sparring with him and learning to understand him and him learning to understand me. And we had a great relationship over the years. And that's what happens when Rob's there at the ballpark every single day. You know, everybody knows who he is. And, you know, he's got Josh Donaldson waving to him from third base when they're playing in Toronto, kind of thing. And maybe that's going to come back again.
Well, personally, we miss it. I think professionally, we miss it. The question still to be answered is how much of this kind of Zoom reality continues when we get to the point where we're safer than we are right now. I suspect a lot more than we would like. Guys, we'll let you wander off. We'll watch with interest as the Blue Jays try and secure a postseason berth. They will have to win more than 60% of their games, our producer lets us know, in order to get to 90 wins. And that doesn't even necessarily get you to where Longley thinks they'll need to be. You said 92, you think?
That's my projection, yeah.
Yeah, I can't disagree. Guys, always our pleasure. We'll bug you somewhere down the road. We thank you very much for your time, and we'll see you soon, I hope.
Good. Sounds good. Thanks, guys.
Steve Simmons, Rob Longley. We'll come back after these messages. Thanks again to Steve Simmons, Rob Longley, for being with us. We don't often bounce around from subject to subject, sport to sport, but I think it was mandated by the developments of the last couple of days.
Almost like a round table, Bob. It's almost like a round table.
Well, a little shorter than a round table.
No, but my point is that we had to, even though the plan from the producer was to talk baseball today, you had to address the Lowry issue because it happened last night, right?
Yeah. And this Blue Jay team, I agree with, I think it was Simmons who said, I mean, I really like this team. I really like the makeup of this team. I think they have talent everywhere.
They have flaws, though. That's why, I guess that's what I was alluding to asked.
But the flaws, the bullpen is a big, big question mark. Starting pitching right now looks solid as a rock. Now they got to stay healthy.
You don't think the left side's a flaw still?
Espinal, third base, is
okay.
Is great. I mean, he's not your traditional third baseman. He's not a power hitter.
Right.
He's hitting over 300 and fields as well as anybody. I mean, I don't know where they're going to play Dickerson. I mean, he's a fifth outfielder.
Right.
And he's got talent, and he's going to pinch hit occasionally.
I mean, you can't play five guys, Bob, in the outfield.
You can't play five. So there's the only thing I keep coming back to is they're being hurt by the way the game is played today, probably as much or more than any other team, because their bullpen isn't solid enough to keep them in games.
Right.
And for whatever reason, they don't have that magic thing where they believe they will win every day. They believe, okay, we're down two runs going to the ninth inning. We'll score two.
Right.
I don't know. I don't think that's tangible. Maybe it's all in our heads, but we certainly have seen Blue Jay teams that have that in them. Mm-hmm. And this team does not, at least to this
point. Not yet. Not yet. And it's funny because I thought, and I know it's not an overnight thing, but that was what George Springer was supposed to bring to this team, that kind of attitude.
That left that absolute confidence that we're never out of a game.
Right. Now, and maybe it's coming. Maybe, and we know it takes time. I mean, this is, you can't, despite what you saw in 2015 when at the deadline they were one game under 500, you can't flick a switch and expect things to happen. So the other thing, I assume this also helps the fact that there were some concerns about Ryu's arm and being tired, but with the third starter, it probably, and I know where you're going. I know where you're thinking.
No,
if starting pitcher is a starting pitcher, and get him out there as long as he wants, as long as he needs.
Well, let him throw till his arm falls off.
Yeah, right. I assume that everything will help get Ray and Ryu through the rest of this season.
Well, I think you got to be more concerned too with Manoah. I mean, we've gone through, you know, this is a guy who hasn't thrown very many innings.
Right.
Historically. And he's getting damn close to where, you know, are they going to shut him down? We haven't had that conversation. Is there a number at which they shut him down? Because the guy keeps going out there and throwing 6-7 innings effectively. And other than that little blip where he missed one start, maybe two. Mm-hmm. He's been pretty solid and pretty reliable. But the innings are starting to chalk up. And at what point do you get concerned about that? And I do have that concern a lot more than how many pitches a guy throws in a day. In any event, we'll continue this discussion for however long we stay alive. Because I don't think
what an What an optimist.
Well, I just don't see my opinion changing on any of this. So far, nobody's been able to change it. All right, let's get out of here.
Okay.
We thank you for watching. We thank you for listening, whatever the case may be. And we'll catch you tomorrow if the crick don't rise. For Shannon McCowan, see ya.